Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Adam Francisco, and a guest today, Dr. Russ Dawn. How are you doing?
Doing great. Great to be here.
Yeah, so you're on the show, and because we're going to do an episode on natural law today, and I'm going to kind of just take a second to talk about why we're going to cover this, because it sort of fits in some of what we've done, but it's not a particular Christian doctrine. It's not necessarily an apologetic argument, and it's not like doing somebody in church history. But we had a listener ask us to do an episode on this because they read a book. You guys have the book in front of you. What's the title of that?
Yeah, Natural Law, Lutheran Reappraisal.
And Dr. Francisco has is it a chapter in there or?
Yeah.
Yes. And so somebody, a listener to the show, read that and, you know, recognized you from the show and said, hey, could you guys talk on this subject? And so I've been thinking about that for a little while and how we could do that. And I thought now is as good a time as ever. The listener who actually asked that is a friend of the show, Dave Ruffner, who's currently backpacking in the Utah wilderness with Dr. Keith, who would usually be here as well. So, so when you get back, Dave, there'll be an episode waiting for you on this particular subject. So, we'll dive in a second, but first, Adam, could you please introduce our guest?
Yeah, so Dr. Dawn, Russell Dawn, is an old friend of mine. We first met at the University of Oxford. And when I met him, it was kind of interesting because he was pursuing a bachelor's degree, but he was older than me. And as I learned more about him, learned that he had a career in investment banking with an MBA, and then a career in law with a JD, and then he went back to school, did a bachelor's degree, and I think probably a few other master's degrees, and then finished with a DPhil or what. PhD at the University of Oxford in church history, studying a particular English theologian. He's now currently an associate professor at Concordia University in Irvine in history and political thought, and director of our law and politics minor, and does a whole bunch of other things around the campus.
I had you for one course at Concordia in my senior year, church history.
Yeah, that's right.
Which was actually great breakup because every other course I was doing that semester was either a language or exegetical. So it was
doing three languages at once one time.
But I had you right after Hebrew, right before Greek, and so it was a really nice pause.
Interesting thing, they haven't let me teach that class since, so I don't know what I did wrong.
What did you use as your basic textbook?
It was
Bruce Shelley.
Yeah, Shelley. Plain English.
Great choice.
Yeah.
Great choice. I was introduced to it in seminary, and I was a natural science major for 3 out of 4 years. So I was new to the humanities, and the guy chose La Tourette.
Oh, wow.
2,200 pages.
Yeah.
You know, several volumes. Plain English is a good subtitle for that book. It's really readable.
Yeah, it definitely was.
Yeah. Recently, church history in plain language, right? Is that the full title?
Bruce Shelley in Denver recently died.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Denver Seminary, right?
Yep.
Is that where he was? Yeah.
Used to be Denver Baptist Seminary.
Yes. I grew up about 2 blocks from Denver Seminary.
There were some great guys there.
Yeah.
Still are.
Yeah. Craig Blomberg, I think, is there.
Yep.
Bruce Demarest. Is or was.
Mm-hmm. So today's episode, not on church history, well, maybe a little bit, not really on church history, but on natural law, which is sort of at the intersection of philosophy and ethics, especially is applied in our world today. And so, you know, the basic question to start off with, and this is always really broad, is what is at its very core natural law?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to steal Russ's thunder. He's the law expert. But in short, it is, you said earlier that it's, I think you put it, it's not a Christian doctrine. And it's not a doctrine in the sense that it's central to the Christian faith, but it is a doctrine of Scripture. It draws, at least in the Christian tradition, it's drawn from Romans chapter 2, where Paul writes that the Gentiles who do not have the law, nevertheless by nature, do what the law requires. you know, thereby with their consciences bearing witness, they confirm the law to be written on their hearts. That's Romans 2, 14 through 15. So from that, in the history of the Christian church, there have been authors, Augustine, Thomas Aquinas being probably one of the bigger figures, who have developed a doctrine of natural law that has certainly gone missing in recent decades, if not a century and a half or two centuries. You find it preserved in the Lutheran tradition, the Reformed tradition. Interestingly, it's not just a Christian doctrine, though. You can go back to like classical Athens, 5th century BC, and see natural law themes in the literature from that period. Sophocles' play Antigone plays with the theme of natural law in the sense that there's a, in the extra-biblical sense, natural law is regarded as sort of like this natural moral order that's written into the cosmos that a person can, as you know, to maybe use Aristotelian language, discover if they just think long and hard about it. So the Christian tradition emphasizes that it's sort of part of our moral conscience. The Greco-Roman tradition will say that, but also say it's outside of our head too, open for discovery, and it provides a objective basis for human law and ethics. Martin Luther King Jr., fast forwarding way forward into the 20th century in his,
letter.
1960s, mm-hmm. Where he, after he marches on Birmingham without getting a permit beforehand, a permission to do it, he gets thrown in jail and he writes a letter from a Birmingham jail, mm-hmm. To his fellow clergy who didn't back him up. And he makes the point that, you know, other clergy who were involved in the civil rights movement who criticized Martin Luther King Jr. for doing this without a permit. They said, what you're doing is illegal. You've got to follow the law at the very least. And Martin Luther King Jr. wrote back and said, I do have to follow the law, but a law that doesn't correspond to natural law, a law that is unjust, is no law at all. And he quotes Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and others to support that sort of view or position in the history of the church.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to think of the episode, but I think Dr. Keith read that quote, actually. Maybe it was somewhere near Martin Luther King Jr. Day last year. It came up tangentially in an episode before.
Yeah.
Or maybe you brought it up when we talked about Thomas Aquinas. Too.
Yeah, and you guys accused me of being a Thomist.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
There are some people who will say that knowing what we know from natural law is nowhere near what we get from Revelation. That is, it's so general it might not be of much use. That's thick in our circles.
Yeah.
Just thick.
In general, I think that's kind that is right, but in our circles, like Luther, for example, he can say that the Ten Commandments hypothetically didn't need to be written
because
they're part of natural law. Mm-hmm. It's what people just know is right. And he's talking especially about the second table, Commandments 4 through 10. But
And the idea of natural law was never meant to take away from Scripture or to replace Scripture. The point is to be a tool for understanding laws, human laws that have been made, and the justness or lack of justness of those laws. And so, it's intended that the idea that the main points of natural law be general. Knowing that particular contexts will lead to variations and exceptions and that sort of thing, but they don't lead to exceptions in the foundational points. So it was never intended to be as detailed as Scripture.
Sure.
So you went into sort of history of use, but at its basic premise, would it be fair to say that natural law is basically saying that there is some truth that can be seen in the natural world around us, or some truths that can be known? Outside of Revelation.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to lay that out there kind of as a sentence for that.
And apologetically, I mean, if you read, so we talk quite a bit about C.S. Lewis's Case for Christianity, which is just one piece of his larger Mere Christianity. The whole first part of Mere Christianity Lewis develops an apologetic argument on the basis of natural law, not to add, he makes the point at the very end of that part is that even though I've established that there is some sort of objective standard, Christianity has yet to speak. So it is a, natural law is a, if you will, it's sort of common ground. It's sort of a common moral sense that all people for all times have had. They disagree on details, to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the general principles, like don't take the life of another person arbitrarily without good reason. You know, what good reason for taking life might be has differed, but you just don't take a life without reason is a common assumption of all civilizations. So natural law theorists would say that's an expression of the natural law working out.
Yeah, so societies have laws, right? But not every society has or will use direct revelation. Before the show, we were talking a little bit about Christendom and certain areas. But,
right,
so, but we don't live in that era, right? And so this is sort of a way to approach public discourse where revelation might not be accepted in terms of our law.
Right. So instead of saying, well, this is in the Ten Commandments and therefore it should be our law because the Ten Commandments are written in the Bible and therefore, you know, our law should follow the biblical law, that sort of thing. You know, we have to have some sort of common ground with the culture, not to mention that Ten Commandments might not be the best basis for law for an entire set of laws outside of, 15th century B.C., Israel, but in any case, there are principles that people generally agree on. It is rare to find a legal theorist who will say that there is no such thing as justice, that there is no such thing as right and wrong. They're out there, but they are rare.
Is Rawls one of them?
Yeah, he is.
Thank you.
The notable.
Thank you.
And he even said, you know, it's kind of a private joke among us. They're not quite joke, but it's sort of a private thing that we don't really say out there much, that we actually see that our views of justice really are just preferences. So for most people, they're more than just preferences, and this is how we can use natural law instead of saying, well, let's have the Ten Commandments. Let's just say, well, let's have human nature be the basis of our laws, and then what ends up happening if you properly apply human nature is it will look somewhat like the Ten Commandments: not murdering, not cheating on one spouse, etc.
Yeah, so that's. So it's helpful for public discourse, which is, one of those areas where sometimes Christians struggle. I think about sort of, this is always a generalization when we do this, but evangelical Christianity that, uses Ten Commandments that should be the law you'll see every once in a while in news where a city wants to tear down the Ten Commandments out of a courtroom,
right,
and stuff like that, symbolically. We do live in somewhat of a secular world. I would argue there is some sort of secular religion, religion ruling behind that. But there does have to be some sort of common ground, doesn't there, if we're going to agree on anything at all?
Absolutely. The problem is that even while some thinkers on the extreme left will admit that there are certain binding things that their view of justice is not a mere preference. As soon as you start saying words like natural law, their alarm bells go off. Because natural law has been in their circles dead really since Marx. Marx rejects the notion of any sort of lasting law that transcends cultures. Really, any law is merely just a tool of the party in power. Of the group in power, the class in power. And so a lot of these thinkers have been brought up to think that way. So even though...
Is that why you hear stuff like, well, that's just a social construct?
Right. It's all a social construct. Marx's lasting contribution to Western thought is this sophism, basically, of the social construct. Law is just a social construct. Your view of lasting justice is just a social construct. But then as soon as they're talking about their own pet causes, all of a sudden it's transcendent.
Yeah.
So
different language.
I mean, we see that a lot in, ethics of sexuality today in America. There are no rules, right? But if you try to say there are some, you are now the enemy, right? You've trans. There is a law. It's just against people having laws,
right?
It's kind of interesting logic.
Woodstock.
So what are some of our starting points or bullet points here that we should be covering, or that people need to know to be decently informed on what natural law is, how they might be using it in everyday life without knowing it, and how it works in actual, you know, political discourse?
Right. One of the bullet points I would want to point out is the question, and this is a matter of debate among people who among natural law theorists, and that is, to what extent do we need a notion of a creator and an eternal law? Is, you know, Aquinas said that the natural law is simply the rational creatures sharing in the eternal law. So for him, and for Luther, and really until Grotius in the early 17th century, natural law is tied very much to eternal law, to God's law, if you will. And then things begin to change in the 17th century, and it's not long before natural law is untethered from divine law, untethered from, I think eternal law is probably a better term, and the notion of a creator. Now, that's a slowly developing thing. So when you have, for instance, the American founding era, there are mostly natural law thinkers. They're not necessarily all Christian. Thomas Jefferson, notably, for instance, not really a Christian. But they're, for the lion's share, they are natural law thinkers.
Yeah, you'll see phrases like natural rights, right? Showing up.
Yeah, you know, it's all over the Declaration of Independence, and it is behind the scenes in the Constitution itself. But they are, by and large, not necessarily tethering natural law to God's eternal law. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. It depends on the thinker. And often, if they're tethering it to the idea of God, it's a very generic enlightenment God. If you think of Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their creator. That's as close as he's going to get to God, is this creator God. So what we have mainly in modern discourse is a non-theistic natural law. And there are some excellent natural lawyers out there, natural law theorists, who take us down that road, that natural law, basically their foundational point there is human flourishing. How do we know if it's part of the natural law? Well, if it leads to human flourishing. Hmm. So rather than looking to scripture or eternal law or something like that, it's noting that everyone would agree that we should have human flourishing. So what laws lead to human flourishing? What practices in humanity lead to human flourishing? And so that's, they're often referred to as new natural law theorists, where they're not necessarily connecting it to scripture or to theology. Now, a lot of these are Catholic thinkers. They're not non-Christians. But they're trying to speak into a world that will not accept anything remotely resembling Christianity and divine authority. So that's one of the things we have out there, is this, and this is a dispute. I was recently talking with one of my old law professors, Professor Stephen Smith, who's now down at University of San Diego, and he taught me law. In mercy to him, I won't mention how far back, but it's a while. And he's a great thinker. And as he and I were kibitzing over lunch, he said he can't get there that there can be natural law without a creator. He appreciates the work that the new natural law theorists are doing that does not necessarily tie to scripture and divine law. But he says ultimately we need a creator. I haven't come to a conclusion yet on that. I'm vacillating, I hate to admit.
It's interesting. It's the complete opposite of how Lewis used natural law. You know, if it's there and people recognize it there, he would say, who put it there? Yeah. Right? That's not even a question being asked, right?
Right?
It's sort of one of these, what do they call it, just-so stories. It just has to be there. Otherwise, all hell can break loose. There's no objective foundation of things. I think, I don't know the details anymore. It's been years since I looked at it with any degree of seriousness, but at the Nuremberg trials, wasn't it true that the Nazi side, they defended themselves by saying, the only reason you can accuse us of war crimes is because you're the victors.
Yep.
And implied in that is there is no objective standard.
The movie is wonderful. The old movie, black and white, Spencer Tracy, and Bert Lancaster, one of the German judges, probably the leading German judge, doesn't speak through 9/10 of the movie. And when he finally does speak, that's the argument. You're sitting where you're sitting because you won.
Yeah, because you, I mean...
And Spencer Tracy was thrown back, of course, and finally had to reach to biblical law to justify it.
Interesting.
There's a law above all human law. But there was the chief counsel for the prosecution of the German judges, and he was driven to it by the German judge who raised the pragmatic argument.
Thinking as a historian, isn't it odd that after World War II, the Holocaust, when there's a return in a way to natural and biblical law, that just a decade, two, maybe it's Woodstock, the 60s, right? A return to that same sort of assumption that maybe the Nazis had, and now it's just dominated.
Yeah.
It's just everything's a construct.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I think there are a lot of reasons for it. One of them is simply that this is sex, and now that we have reliable birth control, people want all the sex that they can have without consequences. But I think the seeds of that view were laid long before that, kind of the reaction against Victorian hypermorality, so the gay 90s, as they were once called, meaning the 1890s, that was, Jacques Barzin argues, that's when the real sexual revolution took place. But then we had setbacks in terms of World War I, the Depression, and World War II. So the 20s, or the roaring 20s, are more consonant with what was going on in the gay 90s and you know, basically pre-World War I. And then we have these, you know, then the Depression and World War II. And then, you know, the 50s, he doesn't really talk about that, but I would view that as sort of a new Victorian era. But the licentiousness of the 60s is already lurking in the 50s. You know, Playboy magazine didn't go out of business in 1955. Mm-hmm. Someone was buying that stuff. So this sexual license was building. And so I think that's part of, if you're going to have as much sex as you want without consequences, you're going to have to start denying natural law, because really there's an extent to which birth control is a denial of natural law. I don't want to get into the birth control debate, Catholic versus Protestant, but
please don't.
But there is an interference there with the natural course of things. And then, you know, it's around this time we get into no-fault divorce. So the natural law of the family gets set aside. Well, there, you know, we're not going to make the family, we're not going to enforce the permanence of the family. The permanence of the family is already there in natural law. We're not going to enforce it. And so part of it is sexuality. The other part of it, I think, is the darker side, if you will, of feminism. Feminism begins as a quest for equality, and I believe that's because men had overstepped their roles as the head of the family, right? So they said if man is the head of the family, man is the head of the wife, then all of a sudden, then the wife is really nothing. And so I think men overstepped that boundary. Rather than serving their wives, they were keeping their wives under their thumbs. Women eventually rise up and rightly seek equality in society. Well, by the time we get to the 1960s, equality in society begins to mean sameness in society. So yeah. women and men being same instead of being equal but different. And that, the birth control and abortion and no-fault divorce, this all comes out of that idea of sameness. If women are going to have their true rights, it's going to be because they have to be able to kill their babies without consequences, and because otherwise nature still binds them. So all of this, this sameness and sexuality is all a denial of reality, which is to say it's a denial of natural law. Natural law says the two shall become one flesh, and they're then in that act fruitful and multiplying. And so this is a natural way of things. And the modern American world is, I think, a step away from nature and a step against nature.
Yeah. You're just basically outlining that there are some key places where this battle has broken down. And I think that's one of the areas that we can go into, but we need to take a time for our break. We have a halfway break here, and we'll come back with a quick ad, and then we'll dive into this just a little further.
All right.
Hey there, and welcome to our break. I'm going to highlight another podcast on the 1517 Podcasting Network this week. If you've been listening for the last couple weeks, you know that we recently just launched the Podcast Network, which is a collaboration of all the different audio projects that have been going on at 1517 for the last 4 years or so. There's some shows that are older on there, like Thinking Fellows and Virtue in the Wasteland. I think Virtue in the Wasteland is 5 years old. Thinking Fellows is now in its third year. There's some shows that are brand new. Banned Books, for instance, is 2 weeks old now, or maybe 4 weeks by the time this airs. Sometimes there's a gap between when we record it and when an episode airs. The podcast I want to talk about today is Let the Bird Fly, which has been going on for, I want to say, just over a year. They just finished what looks like episode 51 on Here to Me. So maybe a year, year and a half, depending on if they've been doing half episodes in between stuff, which they do sometimes. They do some clarification episodes to follow up on things they've done or continuation, which is great. But they came to the 1517 Network. Producer / one of the hosts of that is Wade Johnston, who listeners of the show will recognize having been a guest on our show to talk about his book, An Uncompromising Gospel, which is published with the 1517 Publishing House. You can get that at shop.1517legacy.com. I'll put a link to that book in the show notes and a link to the episode where we had Wade on to talk about that. But the premise of the show is a show about living freely in a world given back to us. And so they get into theological material, apologetic material, into books in a way like the Thinking Fellows, but they're always trying to relate it back to freedom of the Christian type conversation, which is really good. And so you'll see a variety of episodes in there, stuff that I don't think Thinking Fellows will necessarily ever do on a show, so you can get things like that over there. They do episodes on breaking down parts of the divine service if you're a Lutheran and what that's about, or even if you're not a Lutheran and you're curious about the differences in the way we worship than your particular denomination does. They have episodes on that, breaking down what our services look like. And we've done things like the sacrament, confession, absolution, but you'll actually see how those are applied to Lutheran worship in their show. It's a great show. The conversation is great. The audio quality is superb. It always sounds crisp and clear. It's definitely a conversation you'll be able to understand. You can go to 1517legacy.com /podcasts, and there all of our podcasts are displayed. Let the Bird Fly has a very distinctive logo. There's a bird bursting out of a cage on it, so you'll see it right away. And you can click on that. You'll get a summary of the show. You'll see a list of the most recent episodes, a little synopsis, and like I said last week, there's links to all the various different podcasting apps that you can listen to this for sure on. There are probably more apps than this that you can get the show on, but these are the ones that we absolutely know that you can get. That means you can get it on any device. You can get it on an iPhone, on an Android phone, on on a laptop of any kind. So go and check that out, 1517legacy.com/podcast. Click on the Let the Bird Fly logo. Go subscribe. Go listen to a couple episodes. It'll definitely be worth your time. Okay, so let's jump into the rest of this show. You said something right before we went to the break, which I thought was really important, and that was the distinction between equality in society and sameness. And I think that's really important because, like you said, there are some things that feminism fought for or fights for that are really great in as far as equality goes. But then there have been some downsides and where that kind of conflict with natural law shows up.
Right. And that's it's a very touchy issue because it's difficult to discern where sameness and equality diverge from one another. There are men out there who want difference to result in a lesser role for women. So I don't deny that there are still men out there who view women as lesser than they do. They may not even acknowledge it, but they do. So I confess all of that to be the case. That being said, just because there are men who want to abuse their position of authority doesn't mean that there is no such thing as a male position of authority or male position of headship. But we need to look at headship through the lens of Christ and his word, and headship there takes this form: husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So basically the call there from Paul in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25 is for men to die for their wives. How did Christ love the church? He gave himself up for her. He died for her. So men are called to die for their wives. As part of that, women are also called, and so basically in that, men are called to be men. And being a man means dying for the sake of your of those who need you, of your wife, of your children. And that might be the one horrific dying for them, or it might be the daily dying for them. That takes more. I mean, it doesn't take more instant courage, but it takes kind of a lifetime of courage to do that. So likewise, as men are dying for their wives and therefore are not oppressing them, women have a place in society and a place in the family as well that is not the same as the place of men.
I mean, one of the areas that gets like immediately evident is biology, right? Like,
exactly.
Women bear children, men don't bear children.
That's right.
And so there are, you know, they're not the same in that regard, but that doesn't mean there isn't an equality of treatment, right? Like
women shouldn't
get medical care because they're women.
Right.
That's a bad position to hold.
Nor do I agree with the notion that, well, women belong in the home. Barefoot and pregnant, that's where a woman should be, something like that. But is a woman the primary caregiver for a child? Naturally, is a woman likely to need time off from work for the late stages of her pregnancy? Well, it depends on the pregnancy, but sure. And then the early child care, absolutely. There's no, to decide that, well, it's more important that I be the same as men and therefore climb the corporate ladder and be out there, outward facing, and slugging it out. That's more important than my role of being the primary caregiver for the next generation. That's where natural law starts to disappear from view. Hmm.
Could you, a couple of things. That last conversation was pregnant with questions for me. could you say then, because I think maybe you could, that like things like maternity leave, laws concerning maternity leave and so on, is a human expression of, it's a deduction from the natural law?
Sure.
Yeah. That's
funny because that's something that, there's a big struggle with this in Silicon Valley. I don't know.
A lot
of people follow this of how do we, because they have a dropout of women in management positions at places like Google and Apple. And for a long time, this has just been said, well, it's because you guys only hire men. But a lot of research has been done. And there's not a way for them to take maternity leave and hop back in. And so some companies are trying to remedy this. Apple would arguably in a bad way saying, well, we'll pay for you to freeze your eggs so you can have children later. Google doing a program where they're paying you for to take extended maternity leave and not lose your position / opportunities and things like that. So there's, we actually see this struggle in definitely if you follow tech world, but in other areas as well.
Yeah. Yes, and there isn't an easy solution for it. I as much as I would be behind the idea of a woman taking maternity leave and not losing her position, then at what point, you know, how long of a maternity leave? I mean, there are practical questions about that. But I do think the idea of this as a deduction from natural law is a good observation.
Yeah. I'm going to use that one in class instead of, I always use an abortion as an example, way to think about nature, natural law in terms of pro-life. But this one is better because it's not as controversial.
Right. Everybody believes
another
in
another thing about your point with women naturally being best suited for raising children, especially in the early days, feeding and so on. I've seen it in Cicero. I've seen it in Luther and a few places in between where Luther in particular, who has a pretty high view of women. He's the first to suggest that girls should be educated right alongside boys in public schools and so on. He talks about his wife, Katie, in one place where, as if she's doing like the most important thing for a civilization. She's, the home is for Luther, the seminarium, the seedbed of the state. I think that's a quote he takes from Cicero. But how it's interesting when you talk about how men have shirked from their responsibilities in many ways, and maybe in not recognizing just how important motherhood is.
Absolutely.
How essential it is for a flourishing society. We could probably go in all sorts of trajectories, though, in terms of...
What's funny is this episode is probably really close to Mother's Day, now that I think about it.
Ah.
Actually, too.
Well, great.
Interesting.
Yeah, but that's exactly the point, is we need mothers. We need fathers, too, and there's certainly a war on fatherhood out there.
Yeah. Being Dad, great resource for that by Dr. Keith, who's not here today. You can check that out at shop.1517legacy.com.
Another question, because I think we're probably kind of running close to the end of time.
We definitely are.
Rook, can natural law thinking be taken too far? Can it be...
Yeah, there are problems.
Can it be turned into sort of like a overly dogmatic... Can you use it in an overly dogmatic way or an ideological way?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
We've seen this in a variety of horrific situations. I hate to draw on the obvious guy, but Hitler. To him it was perfectly natural that the Aryan was superior to others, like the Slavs and the Jews, of mm-hmm. course. And so he turned kind of a twisted notion of natural law into genocide. And that's really what ends up happening, mm-hmm. is we twist natural law, as we're prone to do because we're sinners. Mm-hmm. So natural law can be dangerous because it is not necessarily scriptural. And so we can put our own sinful spin on it and turn it into a way of oppressing someone else. Mm-hmm. Slavery in America in the 17th through 19th centuries, et cetera.
Yeah. I was thinking, we talked a couple days ago about Herbert Spencer and sort of the social Darwinism that emerged in the wake of Darwinian or biological.
Yeah, you kind of, you have to be careful because, there's this whole line of thinking out there that's based on observing nature that life is meaningless, right?
Right.
And or red in tooth and claw.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, but the error there, you're right that there is that, and that's part of the danger. But the error there, it seems almost too obvious that they're relating humanity as if humanity is just another animal. Mm-hmm. So that's where taking natural law without any sort of biblical basis leads you in the wrong direction. Well, we're just animals. Hasn't Darwin just proved that? We're just more advanced mm-hmm. animals, and look at what animals do. So mm-hmm. we should be like them. We take our cues from them. That's a bad theology.
Mm-hmm. You think?
Yeah, so I think this was a helpful episode because, people on the show who listen to the show aren't in just isolated bubbles to themselves, right? We work in public areas. We have coworkers, employers, you know, even just the political system, that it doesn't share our own views. And so this, while natural law isn't just holding to it or studying it, isn't going to be a, you know, a silver bullet solution to any of these, at least considering it can give you a grounds for talking, for conversation, for dialogue between people who are Christian and non-Christian. And perhaps because of those problems that arise when you don't see it in light of biblical revelation, open up an apologetic conversation, in fact, with people as well as you approach those problems. Thanks for coming on the show, Dr. Don. It's good to see you again. It was nice to have somebody, a guest on the show. We haven't had a guest for like a month and a half.
Wow.
So it was really nice to have somebody come on.
Honor to be here. Thank you.
If you have questions for us, we're going to be doing a Q&A episode pretty soon coming up. I have a couple of questions, but there's definitely some blank spots still. So you can go to thinkingfellows.com, and there's a contact button. It's just a basic form where it asks you to put your email address, whatever question you have, send that my way. And if it's a good enough question or it fits where we can do it inside the show, I'll try to squeeze it in. Once again, thank you for listening. You can check out more great shows like the Thinking Fellows at 1517legacy.com/podcast. And we hope to catch you next week.